This is Intelligence Matters, sponsored by Flare, a leader in providing actionable cyber threat intelligence to companies and governments around the world.
Michael Allen is a former senior director at the National Security Council, former staff director at the House Intelligence Committee, and currently a managing director and partner at Beacon Global Strategies. Today, Michael joins both my co-host Andy Macreadis and me to ask us questions about the year ahead in national security. We'll be right back with that discussion after a quick break. I'm Michael Morrell, and this is a special episode of Intelligence Matters. The lines between geopolitical risk and cyber risk are blurring. Flare is a next-generation, continuous threat exposure management SaaS platform that equips corporate information security teams with world-class collection and continuous monitoring across dark web cybercrime forums, markets, Telegram channels, and sources of geopolitical risk. Flare sets up in 30 minutes, creates actionable intelligence from hour one, and is used by governments, security teams, and threat intelligence teams around the world. You can try Flare's free trial at their website, flare.io. That's flare.io. Welcome to this special episode of Intelligence Matters. I'm Michael Morrell. Today we're going to do something that we did a year ago, which is talk about the year ahead in national security, but we're going to do it in a way, the same way we did last year, which was to flip the script. Instead of me interviewing somebody, Michael Allen from Beacon Global Strategies is going to join us again like he did last year, and he's going to interview me and my new co-host, Andy Macreadis, about how we think about national security, foreign policy in 2024. So Andy, welcome. Michael, thank you for doing this. It was a big hit last year. I think we actually got some things right last year, in a scary way, actually. So really looking forward to this conversation. And Michael, over to you.
Well, thanks so much for having me back. I enjoyed it last year, and I think we can take it in new directions this year. I should mention at the outset, since we're all affiliated with Beacon, that these aren't Beacon corporate views. It's our conversation about national security issues in 2024. So why don't we start there, Michael? Let me start with you. What do you anticipate the theme will be over the course of this conversation about 2024?
So, Michael, I think, and Andy, and I've talked a little bit about the podcast. I think our theme is that 2024 is going to bring significant geopolitical, significant national security risk. I think it's probably the most risk going into a year since 2002, when we were facing Al-Qaeda plotting for additional homeland attacks. We were facing Al-Qaeda attempts to get its hands on weapons of mass destruction, in particular nuclear weapons. You know, I think 2022 comes close to where we are. Remember, we went into 2022 facing the very real prospect of a Russian invasion of Ukraine. But I really think that as we talk about 2024, we're going to see even more risk than we saw in 2022.
Well, that's saying a lot right there. Andy, do you want to jump in here?
Yeah, sure. Thanks, Michael. I certainly agree. There's a lot of areas that we could look at. There's, if you take a look around the world, you sort of see the potential for increased territorial disputes around the world. You certainly see them in places like the South China Sea. North Korea is sort of a perennial problem for the United States, or almost certainly be additional saber rattling next year. AI, which is something we can talk about later, I think promises some surprises. And the U.S. is for the first time facing sort of two near peer adversaries. And so you put all that in the mix, and as Michael said, you get a really complex international picture.
Let's call it, Michael, The Year of Living Dangerously. You know, that was a book and a movie about the run-up to the attempted communist revolution in Indonesia in 1965. That killed hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of people. And as we start 2024, it kind of feels like the Year of Living Dangerously to me. Let's make that the title of this podcast.
Okay. All right. I almost said that sounds good, but that's not good news. Let's go straight to Ukraine. Andy, let's begin with you. Of course, we'll see here in the beginning of the year what we hope will be a successful congressional action to approve more funding for Ukraine. But where do we sit as we begin the year on the battle? Give us a sense of what's going on the battlefield.
Yeah. So, I think we can look at this in sort of two layers. And, you know, we're approaching, the two-year mark of the Russian invasion. And we've entered, at least at the first layer, sort of a new chapter, maybe a grueling new chapter, with sort of slow advances, sort of a grinding attrition, what people sometimes refer to as positional warfare. There's some recent declassified U.S. intelligence reports that, came up with Russia having suffered 315,000 dead or wounded. And now it's important to note that they started the invasion with 360,000. Now, of course, they've replenished, but that's an amazing attrition rate. If you look at equipment, they started with over 3,000 tanks. They've had 2,200 of them destroyed, so much so that they've sort of reverted to 70s era T-62 tanks. The numbers in Ukraine are a little more tricky, but reports sort of suggest about 70,000 killed, and I don't have a good number for wounded. But if you take a look at the map and you look at in the east first, and you see Donbas, sort of the epicenter of where all this started, that's locked in a bit of a tug of war between the Russian forces and Ukrainian forces, and it's sort of a tit for tat back and forth. You move down, you look into the southeast, a place called Zaporizhia, big artillery duels back and forth, reminiscent of previous wars. Moving further south, Kherson, you have both forces sort of in these stalled defensive positions. And in Crimea, which is further south, there are reports that the Ukrainians have used rockets to strike Crimea. I don't know where that will sort of lead, but Ukraine has talked about mobilizing an additional 500,000 troops. Recently, the Russian defense minister Shoigu said that just this year, 335,000 soldiers had signed up in Russia. I don't know how much you want to believe those numbers, but there's this constant need for backfilling. And ultimately, the big disappointment in all this is that the Ukrainian counteroffensive failed. And there's really no other way to put it. Their major objective was to break through this land bridge that runs across southern Ukraine. So if you're looking at a map, it's sort of this comma-shaped strip of land from the Donbas down to Kherson, which I mentioned. And below that is Crimea. So it provides the Russians with a buffer on Crimea. And the Ukrainians were not able to break through that. They, in 6 months of fighting, they may have gained 100 or so kilometers for a number of reasons, maybe inexperienced troops, some new tactics. But, the Russians started out very badly at the beginning of this, if you all recall. And they've adopted, like, most militaries do. And so strong defenses. But if we just look below that first layer, things are getting much worse for Ukraine. I had a great talk with Andrea Kendall Taylor the other day, and we had her on the show back in, I guess it was September, October of 2024.
She's a former CIA Russia analyst.
CIA Russia analyst. And her view of this is sort of some of the things that I'd been sort of seeing, and that's, look all along the front, and the Russians are outfiring the Ukrainians 4 or 5 to 1 in some of these artillery and rocket battles. Ukraine has already begun to feel the impact of the funding problems. We just saw recently the EU The aid package was vetoed by Viktor Orban of Hungary. That was going to be $50 billion. The Russians have begun to make small advances, not significant, but the trend line is upwards. And so you get this feeling that the momentum has begun to shift.
Well, you're right about the counteroffensive. So many times we heard that the Ukrainian aim for 2023 was to get down to Melitopol, to come within striking distance of Ukraine and to break the land bridge, as you say. And so they've certainly fallen well short of this. And Michael, this allows me to come back to you on just sort of a subset of geopolitical risk. And that's sort of the Washington risk, or sometimes the Western politics risk, that Ukraine is facing. I remember thinking at the beginning of last year, when people said, how are you going to get Ukraine done, we the United States, in 2024? And I would always say, you know, America loves a winner. And I think we'll be there for the Ukrainians on that basis. But it hasn't gone well, as Andy just explained. And so take us through this other risk.
Let me say a few things, Michael, and then let me get you to respond to what I say, because you're actually more of an expert on this than I am. I think 2024 is going to determine the future of Western support for Ukraine. You can see and you can feel the attention to the Ukraine war fading in the West. You can see and feel the willingness to continue the military and financial support for Ukraine starting to fade, both in the U.S. and Europe. You know, members of Congress are playing politics with support to Ukraine. Not saying I disagree with what they're asking for. I'm just saying they're playing politics. And the U.S. presidential election may well have candidates with sharply contrasting views of whether the United States should continue to support Ukraine at all. And I guess I can't make the following point strongly enough. The future of Western support to Ukraine is going to determine the very future of Ukraine itself. The outcome of the war depends on the West. If Western support is sustained and even expanded to get Ukraine what it needs, Ukraine will win. They will eventually drive Russia out of much of the territory it currently holds. But if that support erodes away or ends in a single moment, Russia's going to win, and it will reach its maximalist goals, which means the entirety of Ukraine will either become a Russian vassal state or it will become incorporated into Russia. You know, there's a, I feel very strongly about this. There are a couple of different ways to put this. One is that Western support is existential to Ukraine. And two, the outcome of the war is not going to be determined in Kyiv or Moscow. It's going to be determined in Washington and, to a lesser extent, European capitals.
Yeah, I think you're right. I was over there in October. The Ukrainians underlined for us that it is existential to them. And they were very frank. They were respectful, but they were frank. They said, listen, we rely on the United States completely. We don't want to be in this position. No one wants to be. No nation wants to be overly dependent on one country. But they said, without you, we are not going to be able to hold them back for long. The good news is, I'll give us a little optimism going into 2024. I think the votes are there in the House of Representatives for Ukraine. I think there's a majority of the House Republican Conference that support it, and certainly a large majority of the House. The problem isn't the votes, it's getting to the vote and having the vote. And it's true that I think the Republicans do want to make progress on border security, but it's also that there's some discomfort in the way that President Biden has conducted the war. The critique that Biden has piecemealed assistance, slow-walked certain sophisticated equipment over and over again, I think has taken a toll, not only on pro-Ukraine Republicans, but many Democrats have said as much as well, which is, do we want them to win or do we just want them to not lose?
Here's another thing I think that's important for people to understand is that Ukraine winning is going to take time. You know, even if they got all the support they needed, the war would not be over in 2024. A Ukraine win is going to take several years of more fighting. And during that time, we have to maintain both our attention span, right, and the will to sustain the support. So not only into 2024, but well beyond. And maybe one more final thought from me, Michael, is that if we don't sustain the support to Ukraine, history is not going to be kind to the Western leaders who fail Ukraine. History will judge them harshly.
I think so too. I think in the broad sweep of history, things will look back and it won't be understandable why we didn't forward more airplanes and tanks and artillery as quickly as we can. Let's move to the Middle East. Andy, let me start here with you again. Where are we on the battlefield? And how much of Hamas's military capabilities have been degraded? It seems really hard to come up with some metrics. I know the Israelis have said they've killed 2,000 to 3,000 Hamas fighters, but how do we judge what kind of progress they're making?
Yeah, I think this is a really tough one. And you know, there's a definitional problem. You know, what does it mean to destroy or degrade Hamas? I mean, it's not a standing army where you can actually, you know, measure, you know, they had 3,000 tanks, now they have 2,000 tanks or whatever the case is. The most recent estimate that I saw, Michael, an Israeli estimate. So, you know, that you have to pay attention to the numbers a little bit, but they think they've, you know, killed 5,000 militants. Now, if you look at total numbers of Hamas, it's about 30,000. You know, you can make of that what you will. But it's going to be very difficult for the Israelis to say they've degraded or destroyed Hamas in any reasonable way. You know, much of the leadership of Hamas is not in Gaza. And so they're external to the country. And, you know, the fighters melt right in to the population. So it's not like you can spot the uniform and say, oh, there's, you know, a Hamas fighter. You know, what the Israelis are, you know, I think the Israelis believe they have 6 months to do this. I don't think they have anywhere near that amount of time. But I think their going in position was they had 6 months to do this. And, you know, if you look at where they are in the phases of the war, that in northern Gaza, I think they're trying to move from sort of clearing operations to holding operations, meaning that, you know, they're going to continue to disrupt, you know, enemy activities, but they want to try to provide a more secure environment. And that's not a quick thing, but their focus has begun to shift more towards the south, to a place called Khan Yunis, which is the second largest city in Gaza, where the IDF believes, you know, much of the military leadership of Hamas is hiding in tunnels. And that's where much of the significant fighting has started to ramp up. You know, if you look at what the Israelis really want, there's two people they really want. Yahya Sinwar and this guy named Mohammed Daif, because they believe that they were sort of the masterminds behind all this. And so I don't know if they can get them, will that give them an ability to say, okay, we accomplished part of our mission? But this is a real, you know, definitional problem.
Andy, do we have a sense of how much of Hamas's military infrastructure in terms of, you know, rockets and drones and their ability to bring those things into Gaza has been degraded or not?
Michael, it's really hard. You get all kinds of conflicting reports, and it's hard to tell because the initial stockpile is a little bit of a mystery. You know, how much do they have? How much did they start with? So it's a little tricky to find out if you know, because of the constant battering, have they lost a significant portion of their weapons, or are they hidden in tunnels and they just haven't rolled them out? So this is one of the problems that the Israelis deal with. It's hard to tell how much they've actually, quote unquote, you know, degraded Hamas capabilities.
Yeah. Hey, Michael, just one thing to add on sort of where we are in the fighting. You know, Israel might be winning, you know, or not so much, the war on the ground, but without a doubt, Hamas is winning the information war. Hamas is winning hearts and minds. You know, I've seen some polling. Support for Hamas has grown significantly, you know, on the Arab street, but also around the world. You know, as both of you know, there's even support for Hamas right here in the United States, you know, which is kind of shocking in a country that, you know, just 21 years ago suffered the 9/11 attacks. So I think, you know, there's winning the war, or there's winning the battle in Gaza, right? And then there's losing the war, which I'm a little worried that we're heading in that direction, you know, given how people are reacting to civilian casualties in Gaza.
So, you know, Michael, that it just strikes me that Hamas has one strategic objective, and that's to survive long enough that international pressure will cause the Israelis to pull back. Right.
And even more than that, right? Even more than that, make Israel a pariah state, right? Internationally, certainly in the Middle East and internationally. And maybe both of those objectives are in sight for them.
Well, Michael, that's a nice segue to what I wanted to ask you about next, because I do believe the Israelis know that they're not winning the battle of public opinion. But to them, they say, well, listen, our sense of security was shattered on October 7th. And we talk now about the Israeli psyche and what they need or what they feel like they need to accomplish in order to reestablish some sense of security. And that gets to the question of what are the chances of a regional escalation? There are just so many potential flashpoints as we look forward to next year. What do you think?
Yeah, Michael, you and I have talked about this, you know, a lot in the last 2 months. I think in terms of the war spreading, I think it's analytically useful to break the risk into the short term and the medium term. And I think in the short term, any spread of fighting that occurs, you know, significant fighting, there's already fighting, right? Significant fighting that occurs is going to be unintentional, is going to be the result of unintended escalation from successful missile, rocket, drone attacks by Hezbollah into northern Israel, by Iraqi Shia militant groups against U.S. military sites in Iraq or Syria, or against the U.S. embassy in Baghdad, or by the Houthis in Yemen against commercial shipping or naval vessels in the Red Sea, right? It's going to be somebody getting lucky with one of those attacks, and the U.S. or Israel needing to respond, you know, with no intention of the war escalating, but somehow that process leads to a larger war. That's kind of the short term. I think the medium term is more difficult to assess, but I think it's more dangerous because it could involve an intentional war. And here we get to the issue that you just raised, which is the Israeli psyche. I think it's safe to say that their psyche was shocked and shattered on October 7th. They do not feel safe in their own country, you know, at this point. You know, Gallup does a poll in Israel every year where they ask about worry and stress. And in the poll that was just conducted, both of those, worry and stress, were at record highs. And right before October 7th, they were at record lows over the 25 years that this survey has been conducted. So the psyche issue you talk about is real. And the question, right, the question in the medium term is, where will that psyche lead? Where will it lead Israeli politics? Where will it lead Israeli policy? Will Israel conclude that they can no longer tolerate the Hezbollah army in Lebanon? You know, that at the end of the day is much more capable than Hamas was on October 7th. You know, will Israel come to the conclusion that they can no longer coexist with the revolutionary government in Iran, you know, which is supporting both Hamas and Hezbollah? Will the Iranians themselves conclude that there's a risk that Israel might attack them and move now to build and test a nuclear weapon, right, to provide the ultimate deterrent? You know, which U.S. intelligence and Israeli intelligence would most likely see and possibly move both countries to preempt. So I think there's a ton of uncertainty and danger in the medium term. And I think that what transpires in 2024 is going to, you know, largely determine the degree of that risk that we're going to face going forward.
That's fascinating. Andy, let me ask you, I think in the days after October 7th, a lot of people wondered whether this attack was coordinated with Hezbollah and whether they would begin an attack on Israel. It hasn't panned out so far, but handicap this for us going forward. And if they're not going to go forward, in your estimation, what conditions would need to occur before you would begin to think it's more likely than not that Hezbollah is going to do something against Israel?
Gosh, you're right. And you know, a sort of this coordinated, you know, attack that a lot of people were talking about sort of hasn't materialized. I think all this depends on how long Israeli forces stay in Gaza. So, you know, the longer that continues, I think that's what increases the chances for other attacks, either in the West Bank or Hezbollah. And so the sooner that Israel can begin to move into some, you know, second part of this, it will begin to diminish the possibilities of additional attacks. Michael highlighted the key point, though, here, or one of the key points, and that's Iran. And while I'm not suggesting Iran coordinated all this, you know, it's hard for anyone who looks at this to believe that Iran wasn't fully aware of what was going to happen. And, you know, they have their proxies. And so getting to a point where you can sort of ease back and believe that you're not going to get these other attacks all sort of pivots, I think, in many ways on Iran and Iran's view. But as the longer Israel stays and the more you see of the devastation, that I think that the odds begin to increase.
You know, I think it's important that to kind of remember that if Hezbollah decides to open up a second front, you know, in a major way, as opposed to what they're doing now every day, right? That's a decision that's going to be made in Tehran. Hezbollah is not going to make that decision themselves. And it really goes back to a point Israel has made for a very long time, right? Is all this stuff ties back to Iran and to the Supreme Leader and to the Quds Force. And, you know, I don't see any intelligence anymore. I don't get briefed. I don't, you know, have any insight. But boy, do I have a sense that the Iranians are turning up the dial, right? Have their hand on a dial with their proxies, with Hezbollah, with the Shia militants, with the Houthis. You know, before the ceasefire, there were daily attacks by these groups. The ceasefire came, they stopped. And then the ceasefire ended, they started again, and they actually picked up steam. So it really feels like somebody in Tehran is calling the shots here. And that the Iranians, far from being deterred, right, by the United States as they need to be, don't seem to be concerned enough about what it is they're doing here. We're going to take a quick break, and we'll be right back with more of our discussion.
Beacon Global Strategies is the premier national security advisory firm. Beacon works side by side with leading companies to help them understand national security policy, geopolitical risk, global technology policy, and federal procurement trends. Beacon's insight gives business leaders the decision advantage. Founded in 2013, Beacon develops and supports the execution of bespoke strategies to mitigate business risk, drive growth, and navigate a complex geopolitical environment. With a bipartisan team and decades of experience, Beacon provides a global perspective to help clients tackle their toughest challenges.
So, Michael, on this, it seems to me, since October 7th, that the Biden administration should have indicated in one way, shape, or form that a broad revisit of U.S. policy toward Iran is now in order. I know there's intelligence questions about how much they may or may not have known on October 7th, whether they were in direct control or not. Do you think we'll finally see a broad revisit of Iranian policy? And a subset of that is, you know these players, you were in the White House Situation Room so often, as you see their proxies taking shots at us, certainly in Iraq and certainly in the Red Sea, why hasn't the United States acted to restore deterrence? You can't turn on the television without seeing a former general say as much.
Yeah, there's a lot of questions there. Let me just start by saying, you know, it certainly matters whether the Iranians were directly involved in some way on October 7th. But at the same time, it doesn't really matter because the Iranians have been supporting Hamas for a very long time. They've been providing weapons to Hamas for a very long time. You know, over the last 3-4 years, record numbers of weapons have crossed the border, you know, from Egypt into Gaza, you know, Iranian weapons. The fact that Hamas fought, you know, in a very sophisticated way on October 7th and continues to fight in a pretty sophisticated way tells me that they've had outside training, whether that's come from Hezbollah or Iran, I don't know. But, you know, Iran is in part responsible for what happened here, irregardless of whether they specifically supported October 7th or not. So that's point number one. Point number two is I think it's remarkable that American generals who tend not to critique foreign policy once they leave their jobs have been so vocal in arguing that we need greater deterrence against the Iranians and the Houthis and the Shia militants and Hezbollah. I think that's pretty remarkable. I think there was a letter with most, if not all, former CENTCOM commanders, you know, saying we needed to do more. And I would certainly align myself with that, and I'm guessing you would too. And I think the third point is we do need a reassessment of our policy toward Iran. But I don't think it's going to happen. You know, this is the last year of a presidency. This is a presidential election year. You know, a reassessment is sort of an admission that you didn't have it right. And they're not going to want to send that message. So I think a reassessment is going to have to wait for the first months, certainly the first year of the next administration, whether that's another Biden administration, whether that's a Trump administration, whether that's a Nikki Haley administration, you know, whichever it is, I think that's when the reassessment's going to come, unfortunately.
Got it. Andy, one more question on the Middle East, and then we're going to turn to China. There's so much discussion on a post-conflict Gaza. It seems like the Biden administration's position is that we need a quote-unquote renewed Palestinian authority, at least in a short to medium term going forward. But I hear across the political spectrum people say, well, you know what, the Palestinian authority is hopelessly corrupt and can't get the job done. What are we going to do here, and how do you foresee any progress or activity on this front going into 2024?
Yeah, so... you know, if you look at the last 50 plus years of Gaza, it's been run by three entities, and only three. 1967 for close to 40 years, the Israelis, for like a year to two, the Palestinian Authority, and then Hamas. And so those are the three players. The idea that the Israelis are going to stay long-term, non-starter. You know, that's just not going to happen. Hamas is utterly unacceptable. So as bad as it seems, the only thing you're, unless, you know, some new Palestinian government, some new charismatic leader pops up that can sort of mobilize people and lead, which seems unlikely, you're left with the Palestinian Authority. And they're 100%, they're corrupt. Mahmoud Abbas is terrible. He has sabotaged the Palestinian Authority by not bringing in young, new leaders. He has to go. It absolutely has to be revamped. But it's one of those things where there's no good choice. And so you're trying to figure out what's the best of the worst possible choices to pick. And that tends to be the Palestinian Authority. You can't leave it ungoverned because that creates a whole, you know, another suite of problems. So, you know, there's a great article by Daniel Kurtzer, a former U.S. ambassador to both Egypt and Israel, that appeared in The Atlantic in December. And you know, he talks about a phased diplomatic approach, which is security inside Gaza and then some type of a transitional government and then helping revamp the Palestinian Authority so they can actually govern. But that would mean, you know, removing people like Abbas. And then a big role for American leadership. I just don't, this is one of those you're damned if you do, damned if you don't kind of things. And, you know, the rest of the Arab nations are going to have to get involved here. No, this can't be just a problem they admire. And the UN is going to have to get involved if there's a transitional government before the Palestinian Authority is ready. But it's somewhat of an intractable problem.
You know, it's interesting. It's interesting, Michael, if I could just make one point. You know, there's, if you think about governance, and I agree with everything that Andy said, if you think about governance, there's two things that a government in Gaza has to be able to do, you know, the day the Israelis leave. People talk about the day after. I like talking about the day the Israelis leave. One is to provide the humanitarian needs of the Gazans, right? Food, medicine, water, shelter, basic stuff. And then the other is to provide security. So while a better version of the PA that Andy's talking about, you know, might be able to provide the first, you know, to organize all of that because it's going to come from the outside, where's the security going to come from? You know, it's nobody's going to accept American troops, including Americans. Nobody's going to accept the UN, I don't think. The Gazans.
So, Michael, does that have to be a sort of a pan-Arab?
I think that's what it has to be. I think the GCC, right, needs to stand up here and do the right thing. But I don't see any interest on their part in doing that. They'd be taking huge risks. So the post-Israel, you know, post-combat issues facing Gaza are huge, and will affect those things we talked about, right? Israeli psyche, how the Iranians see this, how Hezbollah sees this, you know, how the world sees Israel. This is the huge issues.
Michael, I just add one more thing with what Michael Morrell just said. And that's at the same time that you're doing this, I can't see this happening unless there are serious two-state solution negotiations going on, real discussions. Because just, you know, allowing a Palestinian Authority to run Gaza without any sort of two-state future seems like we're going to be back to where we are today.
And all of this is also, we haven't heard from what Netanyahu thinks of any of this, or maybe we have. He's totally not on board with a lot of these discussions, and Israeli politics is a major variable going into 2024. Let's shift over to China, Michael. Where do you think the relationship stands going into 2024?
Michael, I would expect that tensions between China and the United States are likely to grow perhaps significantly in 2024. They're going to grow because, you know, China is going to feel the need to protest, probably with military exercises, the likely outcome of the Taiwan presidential election, which will be the election of the current vice president. you know, who's pretty anti-China. The U.S., of course, will feel a need to protest what the Chinese do there. They're going to grow because of the heat of what it is going to be a hotly contested presidential election in the U.S., where each side is going to be trying to outdo each other with its anti-China rhetoric, and the Chinese are going to need to feel, are going to feel the need to respond to that. It's going to grow because both sides are going to continue to kind of up the ante with what they're willing to sell each other. I just saw yesterday, a couple days ago, you know, the Chinese said they're no longer going to export the technology to mine rare earth metals, right, as a shot back at us on semiconductor sanctions. It's going to grow because of the activity in the South China Sea that Andy talked about earlier, you know, the growing tensions with the Philippines. So I think that's all going to grow. I think the biggest risk regarding China in 2024 is it's not going to get the attention that it deserves, given Ukraine number one, and more importantly, given the Middle East number two. You know, I saw a few weeks ago that a report out of the White House that Biden is spending nearly all of his time on the Middle East. And you know, there's only 24 hours in a day. There's only so much time that you can have meetings in the sit room. And I think China may be the beneficiary of our focus on Ukraine and the Middle East going forward.
Andy, one silver lining for the U.S. industrial base of the fighting in Ukraine is that it pointed out the need for us to ramp up our capacity quickly. Now, it may not be quickly enough, but at least we got a jump start on what we may need to be doing to remain the arsenal of democracy around the world. How do you see the defense industrial base and these concerns playing out in the next year? And do you think that knowing we're trying to ramp up and that we might not be ramped up for a little bit, does Xi Jinping see that as an opportunity to go ahead and move against us before we're ready to reestablish strong deterrence in Asia?
So, you know, you're right about a sort of a hidden silver lining, right? It has sort of, you know, awakened us to the fact that we don't have the manufacturing capability to be able to sustain any kind of prolonged conflict, or let alone multiple conflicts at the same time. So, I really do think you're going to see the defense industrial complex in the U.S. sort of on overdrive over the next year. I mean, let's face it. If you looked at the war in Ukraine, it pivots in many ways on three weapons. Early in the conflict, Javelin, sort of the middle of the conflict, HIMARS, the rocket system, and then most recently on ATACMS, the more sophisticated rocket system. These are the weapons the Russians are most afraid of. And so you're right about this sort of arsenal of democracy. So it will give a huge boost, I think, to the U.S., you know, military industrial complex. As far as Xi Jinping goes, I just don't think they're ready to... You know, if your question was, you know, will they go up for Taiwan, if that's where you were sort of headed, I just don't think that they're prepared. You know, I think watching Russia Ukraine probably has given them a little pause. You know, the Russians were on a multi-decade modernization program with their military, and it doesn't stack up to Western weapons. It's not even close. And so I think it probably places a seed of doubt in the Chinese, who haven't fought a war since, what, 79 against Vietnam? Which they lost. That's exactly right, which they lost. And, you know, and then there are internal problems. You know, Michael and I at different times ran the same office, and one of the key metrics we looked at to look at China and China's stability was their GDP. And, you know, we would get routine briefings, at least I did, I'm sure you did, Michael, about, you know, what's the GDP going to be for next year, so on and so forth. And that's really begun to slide to probably below 5%, which is a big deal. Foreign direct investment in China has dropped to, its lowest level since the late 90s. youth unemployment's at 25%. So there's a lot of internal problems, and I don't think they believe, you know, a war for the purposes of distraction is probably not what they're thinking, because the number one priority for any leader of China is the party and the maintaining the party's control. And when you open up a Pandora box like a conflict, even if you think you're going to win, you know, things could go sideways, as the Russians have sort of seen. So, you know, do they still want to, you know, bring Taiwan, you know, under their control? Absolutely. Are they going to move against them anytime soon? I don't know. I'd be curious what you guys think, but it just doesn't seem to be in the cards.
A couple thoughts. One is that you know, Andy raised China's internal problems. I think of which they are significant, right? I mean, I had Tom Donilon and Steve Hadley recently on a podcast, and Steve reminded people, you know, China is not 12 foot tall. China's got very serious problems. And I think 2024 is going to give us much better insight into China's ability to deal with its huge problems. Whether these are going to result in a significant slowdown in economic growth over the long term, you know, maybe even stagnant growth over the long term, or whether they're going to be able to work their way through this. I think we're going to get a good idea of that by the end of 2024. The other thing I'd say is you asked about a reassessment of our Iran policy. I think we also need a reassessment, you know, at the beginning of the next administration on our China policy. I've never understood what the Biden administration's goals are vis-a-vis China. You know, we've not articulated them. Secretary of State, National Security Advisor, President, they've never stood up and said, here's what we want the world to look like. And here's what our strategy on China is built to achieve. And as I think about what the most likely, you know, objectives are, you know, it doesn't look good. If the goal is to change Chinese behavior in the world, there's zero sign that that's working. If it's to contain Chinese influence in the world, that doesn't seem to be working. And, you know, they sort of own the global South now. And if it's to deter China from attacking Taiwan, you know, the deterrent seems to be weakening, not strengthening. I agree 100% that they're not going to go to war anytime soon, but deterrence is not heading in the right direction for us. So I think there needs to be, you know, a reassessment of what our objectives are vis-a-vis China, what's our strategy and set of policies to achieve that. And that needs to be articulated to the Chinese and to the American people as clearly as possible.
Well said. Okay. As we begin to wind up, let me ask a couple of open-ended questions. What have we not discussed here that may rear its head in 2024?
Maybe I'll just jump in first. Let me mention one general thing and two specific things. The general thing is that the international order that we put in place after World War II is eroding. And I would look around the world where there are, actually Andy mentioned this earlier, look around the world where there are territorial disputes and make sure that we're watching all of those very closely, because as the international order starts to erode, countries will think about taking military action against their neighbors where they have differences of opinion on borders and the like, and resources. And I wouldn't be surprised if in 2024 we see another war similar to what we're seeing in Ukraine, just maybe on a smaller scale somewhere in the world. That's the general point. And then the two specific points is I didn't want to mention Venezuela, but I wanted to mention it not in a military sense, which we've talked about before, but in a political sense. So there's going to be an election, presidential election in Venezuela, and I think the result is going to be just the opposite of what the United States hopes for. I think Maduro is going to win, and I think he's going to win by cheating. And I think it's going to make our policy towards Venezuela look foolish. You know, we basically bribed them. We basically said, we'll remove sanctions if you agree to have a fair, free and fair presidential election. Instead of saying, you know, if you have a free and fair presidential election, we'll remove sanctions. We actually removed sanctions beforehand. And they're not living up to them. And I think it's not going to turn out in a way that's good for the Venezuelan people. It's not going to turn out in a way that's good for Latin America, and it's not going to turn out in a way that's good for the United States. And it's so bad, right? It's going to be so bad that it's essentially going to look like the exit from Afghanistan without the pictures from the airport. The other specific thing I'll mention is I would not be surprised at all by a significant terrorist attack somewhere in the world against a U.S. embassy, against an Israeli embassy, against a Jewish entity somewhere in the world, by the Iranians, by Hezbollah. I'm talking about a large, you know, large truck bomb kind of attack. Or I wouldn't be surprised by a lone wolf attack or even series of lone wolf attacks in Europe or the United States motivated by the war in Gaza. So that's what I'll put on the table. Very cheery.
Well, we should definitely think about Iran in this context, not just with Hezbollah, but they've tried to assassinate U.S. officials as well. Not only tried to penetrate the United States, but certainly they've tried to do things overseas. Andy, you were, among many other jobs that you had at the agency, you were one of the leaders on artificial intelligence. And you mentioned that as something that we should think about in 2024. It really came on the scene in a larger way in 2023. But why don't you sort of handicap what did we learn in the last half of 2023 about national security and AI, and what do you foresee next year?
So, you know, you're right. I mean, AI has just exploded, you know, over the last year since November 22 with ChatGPT, people beginning to realize the potential for AI. First, just the U.S. is unquestionably the world leader in AI. And that's probably not going to change anytime soon. And I know we like to talk about the Chinese as being 10 feet tall, but the U.S. is clearly the leader. However, you don't need to be the leader in order to use AI in mischievous ways. And we've already begun to see the sophistication of AI with things like deep fakes. One of the biggest challenges, I think, for people in general, but the intelligence community in particular, going forward, especially maybe in the next year or two, is being able to tell real from fake. And AI has become so sophisticated in many ways that the fakes are very difficult to detect. On top of that, it brings capabilities to those who use it that they might not have access to before. So it sort of levels the playing field in many ways. So an adversary, let's call it a smaller adversary, so call it North Korea, can do a lot of damage, using AI as an attack vector that they couldn't have achieved in any other way, against, the United States or anybody that they chose. So it's this democratization of capabilities that can be used in nefarious ways. That is one of the more concerning things about AI and what it can do. The U.S. will maintain the edge, but, you can't discount the cleverness of people who may not have the same capabilities, but have access to AI that's good enough.
And are willing to do things that
we wouldn't, right?
Yeah, that we wouldn't.
And so that's one of the other areas where, as we talk about putting guide rails on AI, which we all understand, right? And some of the big large language model companies made voluntary commitments to the White House about what they would do. If you think about a country that's, or an actor, it doesn't have to be a country that's completely unrestricted. You know, what could they do if they didn't have any, if they had access to AI that didn't have any guide rails on it? So I think this year will be a very challenging, I mean, another, you know, year of AI kind of thing. And with, so yeah, I just saw the other day, worldwide, there are 50 elections in 24, which is a record. And so the opportunity for mischief across the board is enormous.
Including and in the United States of America, right?
Yep. Yes.
I wouldn't be surprised to see deep fakes,
sure.
You know, in the U.S. presidential election campaign.
Sure. So, anyway, I mean, it's a great technology. It will help humanity. I'm not worried about it taking over or any of that kind of thing, becoming sentient and, you know, becoming the ruler of the world kind of thing. But it also has, for the first time, some huge dangers that we haven't faced before.
It has the real possibility of making electoral interference and taking it to a whole new level. Well, Michael and Andy, thanks so much for letting me join today. As you coined the phrase for this year, it's going to be the year of living dangerously. So thanks so much.
Thank you, Michael. Thank you, Andy.
Thanks, Michael. Michael.
That was Michael Allen and Andy Macritas. I'm Michael Morrell. Please join us next week for another episode of Intelligence Matters.
Intelligence Matters is produced by Steve Dorsey with assistance from Ashley Berry and Sophia Rubin. Intelligence Matters is a production of Beacon Global Strategies.